Hello and welcome to the Oldie Podcast. I'm Ferdy Rouse, the Oldie's editorial assistant. Today I'm joined by author, nature writer and our Taking a Walk columnist Patrick Barker. Today he's here to tell us about his most recent walk and a bit more about his column in general. So Patrick, tell us about your latest walk.
Well, Ferdy, I had a lovely walk around Glenafric. I've actually done this walk twice, and I did it once in the spring and I did it once more recently just before Christmas. And it is one of those beautiful, stunning Highland walks, but it's also accessible because it isn't scaling one of these enormous Munros or whatever. It's a kind of slightly more gentle, I wouldn't call it gentle actually, that's not the right word, but a lakeside walk where you're going around Glenafric, and it's sort of the perfect sized lake to walk around it very gently in a day. And it's one of these very beautiful glens that the road runs out and it becomes a footpath, and so there's no cars at all and you follow a track and you walk around the lake and you've got this lovely glass watered lake. But unusually for the Highlands, you've got quite a lot of trees too, because Glenafric is one of the last fragments really of the ancient Caledonian pine forest. So you've got these lovely granny pines, which are old twisted Scots pines of kind of 250 years vintage. And that kind of adds to the atmosphere.
No, sure. I mean, so how come the pines are still there? If it's the last vestige, how come?
That's a very good question. And it appears that, some of the land is Forestry Commission, so that may have affected it, that it's been sort of fenced and managed a little bit in that way. A lot of the granny pines are actually out alone on the fell side. And I think it's related to the Highland clearances and the fact that there was this sudden loss of population after Culloden, and basically this area of northwest Scotland was cleared of the native Gaelic speaking people, and so there was a little window when it wasn't heavily farmed, a little window before the sheep farmers came in, and at that point these granny pines got away. And so you've got some of that era, sort of Culloden era granny pines. But the history of the Highlands is fascinating. It wasn't something, I'm certainly not an expert in it, but it wasn't something that I'd really grasped until I went walking up there and read a little bit. And this whole idea that actually this beautiful, what we think of as the archetypal Highland landscape of glorious bare fells with a stag silhouetted at the top, you know, at the crest of the hill, that actually this is a landscape that we've created very much in the last 150, 200 years, really. First with the sheep farming, the sheep farmers that were moved in to the Highlands of Scotland with their lowland sheep varieties. And then when Australia and New Zealand entered the global market and wool price of wool crashed, you had the loss of the sheep and it was replaced by deer and deer stalking. And you've got the Queen Victoria in the 19th century established the kind of what Sir John Lister Kay, who's a Highland-based writer, calls the Balmoral triad of salmon fishing and of grouse shooting and deer stalking. And really the deer stalking estates are what shape the Highlands today. We have a very high population of red deer in particular up there.
And they link to the granny pine issue, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. So they prevent the granny pine offspring from shooting up to become lovely big Scots pines. So apparently the young Scots pines are very tasty indeed to a red deer, particularly when they're just poking up through the snow in midwinter. Very tasty. And so they get nibbled off and then they simply never grow up into these big old pines. So there's a little shortage of sort of 100-year-old pines and 50-year-old pines and the sort of next granny pines. So certainly around Glenafric, there's work to re-establish the old pine woods.
So how are they doing it?
Well, essentially with bits of fencing. And so they have little fenced areas where the deer can't enter, and then you get this amazing regrowth that you realise whilst the fells of Scotland, you know, the high fells would always be above the tree line and clear as they are today. But lower down, like around Glenafric, you would, if left with a lower deer population, you would have many more trees growing back, which is what some big estate owners are now doing in places like Glenfeshy. Essentially, I mean, it's called rewilding, but that's sort of glamorises it really. It's kind of just reducing the deer population down to a level where you get natural regeneration, you get the young pines growing up. And
there's a conflict there between the industry and between the conservation. I mean, is it? I mean, I suppose more broadly speaking, with the Balmoral Triad, I mean, is it actually a positive force in the Highlands? Would you say, or is it? Because it has been suggested, shall we say, but that there are two different sides. I mean, what do you make of it? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, it's you're absolutely right that, you know, if you were totting up what deer stalking and salmon fishing and grouse shooting does for the Scottish economy, it's huge, and of course it draws in many wealthy visitors from the States, and it is the model on which many of these estates are run. I think it would be lovely to have a bit more of a mixture, so you could still have some of those traditional estates, and I personally don't see anything wrong with a bit of stalking and salmon fishing and so on. I'm not one of those people who objects to the sort of pleasure of that, of being outdoors and having days, you know, where when you're a stalker, you have to spend days really looking for these red deer. But I do think it would be nice to have areas where you had lower deer numbers, and you could have a bit more of that ancient Caledonian forest. Sure. And it wouldn't be like this dense plantation forest. It would be like around Glenafric, where there's it's almost like English parkland.
Right.
You know, there's sort of clusters of trees and areas of scrubby bits, and you obviously, as soon as you get more plant life back, you get loads of insects and you get loads of birds. And you get round Africa, you get lovely in spring, there's the descending song of the willow warbler, and and there's grouse shooting off in all directions, and it's a lovely, lovely experience.
Oh, sure. So there's a nice, there is a room for balance between sort of, you know, the commercial side and the actual.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can do both. Yeah, and Scotland, the Highlands of Scotland are a big place. I'm sure there's room for both. You know, at the moment, it's still the deer stalking model is still very much the dominant model.
Sure.
But, you know, that's the way it's been since Queen Victoria's time. There's an argument for saying that we should keep some of that, and Scotland's economy probably needs it and employs people in the Highlands. But we could do some exciting things with getting the natural Caledonian forest back in more places, I think.
Oh, sure. Also, I noticed recently you've done quite a few walks in Scotland. Have you got a particular affinity for it?
Well, I felt I'd slightly neglected it in my column. I've done sort of 2.5 years, I think, now of columns, coming up to 3 years. And because I'm based in Norfolk, there has been a slight East Anglian bias. And I think Wales is even less represented than Scotland, but I thought I'd better correct it. I thought I'd better correct it. And I happen to be in Glasgow. And most of the time, I sort of, because I travel around quite a bit with my writing and giving talks and even with journalism and stuff. And so most of the time, I tend to end up in a place, or know I'm going to a place and think, I must be able to do a good walk there and do some research and find something. So I found myself in Glasgow, for instance, and then read up on this walk along the banks of the Clyde, and which turned out to be really unexpectedly lovely, which I wasn't expecting. And sometimes I go on these walks and I'm not sure if they'll quite make an oldie walk. Don't always.
Because in that walk, I don't remember if I used the right phrase here, but you said something like you were sort of seeking desolation or something. What was the word you used? You used a brilliant sort of...
It might have been bleakness or desolation or something.
Desolation was a bit...
Post-industrial bleakness.
It was bleak seeking, I think.
Bleak seeker, that's it. I don't mind a bit of bleak. It's good now and again.
Let's do it. But I suppose actually that kind of comes on to the next point I was going to ask. Because how do you choose your walks? I mean, obviously the East Anglian bias, we've sort of got an idea. But I mean, but more broadly speaking, do you find the place first and then with the background and then you go for the walk, or how do you do it?
I try and get a bit of a geographical spread. At least have a stab at that. I can't really go to a totally random place 400 miles away every single month, but you sort of work your way around. And then I try and find walks. It's sort of balancing up walks that aren't similar to ones I've done before. But most importantly, I guess, is just a walk that tells a story, or that you can tell a story about something else through the walk. And so just that maybe conveys some interesting bit of history or local geography or a story about a person.
I did
a walk back in the sort of summer, late summer, about Roger Deakin, because it was sort of near his house, and it was on a track that Roger Deakin's a nature writer, and a track that he'd preserved and kind of saved from being ploughed up. And so I thought that makes it more interesting. Obviously just a scenic walk isn't so massively interesting, but and I try and do walks that aren't really, really obvious. Sometimes it's nice to do one that's well walked, you know, and there's a classic walk, and you know, you've seen it in the Sunday supplements or whatever. But I try and do my best to give oldie walkers a few roads less travelled.
But I think that's interesting. I mean, the fact that you call it a walk, and even the fact that the column is called Taking Walk, is something fantastically casual about it. It's not like, you know, this is this big thing which you have to go out of the city to do, and you always make it sort of seem very straightforward. Is that kind of one of the crucial elements to your column, do you think?
Yeah, I think it has to be accessible and it has to be easy, and walking isn't a heroic thing, it's something we do every day, and so it should be open to all of us. And you know, I mean, I don't sort of every month try and ensure that my walk is wheelchair accessible, for instance, and you know, maybe I should look at that a bit more closely than I do, but I do try and make sure that the walks are kind of doable by, you know, able-bodied and less able-bodied people, and people of all ages. And you know, sometimes I'll take my kids along, they're a good gauge of whether a walk's kind of doable. I'm in reasonable shape for a middle-aged guy, so I can do fairly strenuous walks, but I try and make sure that the walks aren't too formidable and can be done by anyone without devastating risks of injury.
Do you have a favourite kind of walk? As a favourite place, like a sort of favourite sort of type of place to walk, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, somewhere walking for me is, whilst to be honest, I enjoy when I'm in London, I found walking places less stressful than taking a tube or whatever, because it keeps you out of the underground, and you know, and you can do some lovely walks in London. But I for me, walking's about kind of communing with the natural world and having space and peace. So my favourite kind of walk is a walk that delivers that. And I enjoy walking with people, but as soon as you're walking with people, you're sort of chatting and not always paying full attention to your surroundings. So I do quite enjoy walks where there aren't that many people around, so not tourist hotspots either, but you know, lonely stretches of beach or quiet woods or you know, meadows. But and I grew up in East Anglia, and I've returned there, but I'm a sort of creature of lowland England, so you can't beat a great walk in lowland England, you know, around the lanes of Devon, or you know, along the coast at you know, Cornwall or North Norfolk, or you know, or even something through some ancient hunting forests in Northamptonshire. You know, all these places just deliver stunning walk after stunning walk.
In terms of like your writing specifically, I mean, I think if I'm right, in the past you said that there's a risk that nature writing, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can slightly fetishise the countryside in a way that isn't necessarily helpful for people. Is that what you think?
Yeah. I think you know, and speaking from as someone who I lived in cities for a long time as an adult and a younger adult, and then I was writing about the countryside, and it sort of, as city dwellers as I then was, I'm now living in the country again, so I feel a bit more less susceptible to sort of romanticising the countryside. But yeah, we do, and we see it as an escape, and it's very good for our physical and our mental well-being, and then we do tend to either paint idealise portraits of it that don't reflect the reality, or we kind of can criticise the people who make a living from the countryside, and particularly the farming and the hunting communities. And I do think a lot of the current crop of British nature writing is fairly urban in its mindset, and it is a fairly urban view of our countryside.
So it kind of writes in snapshots rather than seeing a permanence.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're not there, you're sort of, when you're visiting, you're insulated from the seasons and the change over time, and maybe the times when, yeah, the countryside can be brutal and dangerous and bad for people's health, you know, particularly if we're, I guess none of us, very few of us who write about the countryside are labouring on the countryside and dependent upon our physical labour in the countryside for our income, and that changes your relationship with the place. I mean, I've got friends who are farmers, and you know, they do have a different relationship with it. They can still love it, and I mean, they love it more deeply than we sort of trippers to the countryside do. But, you know, they have a different relationship and they're less likely to romanticise it. I think some of my farmer friends would say that I romanticise it too. And maybe I do, but I sort of feel, because I grew up in the countryside and I've returned there, I sort of feel I have some bond with it that's deeper than just that of a visitor. But, of course, I still, the writing column is me mainly writing about places I don't know as a visitor. Classic travel writing in that sense.
The thing which I sort of found sort of intriguing is that throughout your song, saying about, you know, the countryside and the way we sort of perceive it and idealise it, throughout sort of British culture, really, I mean, you know, since the dawn of time, if that makes sense, you know, you've got, it's a central part of, you know, the literature. You've got Hardy, you've got Blake's Green and Pleasant Land, and yet, as you sort of said, we're kind of having this, there's no real appreciation of that sort of that life anymore. Is there a loss of affection for the countryside, or a loss of respect in a way? I think
around 83% of us in Britain live in urban areas, so we're now an urban nation, and we were the first country, of course, to urbanize. And we were the first country in the world to have a greater portion of our population living in cities than in the countryside. And that was by about the mid-19th century, by about 1861, I think, the census around then, 1851, 61. And so we've been an urban nation for a very long time. And I do think there is we are more disconnected from our countryside than a lot of other nations. And you go to somewhere like, I don't know, Croatia, and a lot of people there who live in cities still have family homes in the country or little places of escape, or Sweden, and these aren't wealthy people with second homes, they're just ordinary folk, and so they've still got a connection even when they're living in a city, whereas we are more disconnected, and I think that does create problems and is the root of this kind of, there's a kind of culture war between city and countryside and a degree of misunderstanding, and I do think that can lead us to treat parts of our landscape with less care than perhaps we should. I was struck, I walked the line of HS2 actually from London to Birmingham. It's in the news, isn't it, very much at the moment, and I was struck by how the route really goes through countryside that's been emptied out of all people, really, and it, beautiful parts of Northamptonshire and Warwickshire, but not sort of the official countryside, which is like the national parks and the Lake District and the Peak District and the Dartmoor and places we all go to, but there's this sort of unsung, unseen English countryside that I really love, and I do think there's a danger that we just fill that with pylons and high-speed rail and new roads and so forth, and perhaps farm it too intensively for wildlife to exist. I do think there's a danger that that happens whilst we remain such an urban nation.
Intrigued what you were saying about sort of seeing that balance between country and city, that kind of culture war which is sort of emerging. I believe you sort of tried to address that in a way in your book Badgerlands. That was kind of a seeing both sides of sort of, in that sense, would you describe your writing as political in that way?
That's a good question, and I would say I'm not a polemical writer in the way that someone like, say, George Monbiot is a polemical writer, and the books he writes, like Feral, which was about rewilding, build a real strong argument for something. I'm really interested in stories and telling other people's stories, actually. I write about nature, but most of my books contain more people than wildlife, and I write about people's differing attitudes towards nature and our relationship with nature in that way. And I'm really interested in stories. I think as you get older and you learn more about the world, I think you become more opinionated, and perhaps my writing has become more opinionated. But I really hope, and certainly I do lots of talks, and I really hope my talks aren't party political. I don't think sort of conservation and wildlife issues are party political at all, and certainly historically I think the Conservative Party's been slightly better than Labour once in government at dealing with environmental issues. So it isn't like an issue that, you know, wildlife lovers either support Conservatives or support Labour, you know. And so I really hope that my book writing is not party political, and I try and make sure it isn't. But I guess these topics that you explore, like a badger cull and so on, is quite political. My next book is called Wild Child, and it's about the relationship between children and nature and how we're ever more disconnected from nature and wildlife. And so in a sense that makes a strong point that I feel that we need to have schooling that gives our children much more access to nature and wildlife, and parents need to be taught, and perhaps even grandparents encouraged to take their children into nature a lot more, and our children will grow up happier and healthier as a result. So that's, I guess that's a slightly political stance, but it isn't party political.
Yeah, sure,
and I'd be very disappointed, actually, if people thought that my writing was party political.
I wasn't trying to pigeonhole you at all.
No.
But if it's not too much of a sneak preview, I mean, do you have a sort of a, I mean, how did you do it as a parent, if that's not a too personal question? You take your children on your walks? I mean, what's your sort of way of getting them into it?
Well, I try and tell them we're going on an adventure, not a walk. It doesn't work. They see through my weasel words, my Orwellian speak instantly. And I remember being dragged on walks as a kid and hating it. But when you get into it, it's really lovely. My kids, I've got 8-year-old twins and a 6-year-old, so they're still quite young, but they're already objecting to going on walks. But once they're there and out in the woods, they're having such a great time. And obviously there's no screens and their imagination is sort of set free. I think being outdoors in green spaces, I mean, it's been shown to be extremely good for our mental health and our sort of cognitive abilities. I think it's really good for imagination, creative thinking, and I hope it's going to help them in that way. I'm sure they will rebel against my parenting and probably take on jobs that keep them indoors or whatever, but I think, and as teenagers always turn away from, you know, nature's very uncool for teenagers, but I think if you're giving your children exposure to wildlife and outdoor places in the first 10 years of their life, I think you're giving them a kind of language, a basic language, that they kind of understand the outdoors and feel at home there, and they'll return there later in life. And I think I'm hoping, gives them a sort of resource that helps them in their later lives. I don't know if I am, but I have one of my three is mad keen on sort of wildlife. One is totally into kind of painting and indoor things, and she describes herself as a sort of indoors person. So, and that's absolutely fine. I'm not going to, you know, love them any differently. But I just hope that we as parents, our generation of parents and grandparents, can perhaps bring our children a little bit more of the outdoors than we have done in recent decades.
Brilliant. I think that's an absolutely perfect place to end. Patrick, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ferdy.